from Valley Public Radio. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. The pandemic's been with us for a year now. And today on our show, we hear from those who arguably have been among the most affected by its ravages, ICU nurses. Plus, we've got another StoryCorps San Joaquin. A Japanese-American remembers the Hiroshima bombing. But first, thousands of migrant workers come to California each year to do temporary labor in the valley and send money back to their families. What has the pandemic been like for them? FM89's Madi Bolaños went to Delano to talk to some workers from Mexico who have been living in a hotel for the past 4 months.
Small groups of men sit outside a Motel 6 just off Highway 99 in Delano. For more than half a year, this is their home. They sit on the stairs or on the grass. One group leans against a fence surrounding an empty pool. They're chatting or taking in the sun, some with the phones to their ears, talking to loved ones back home in Mexico. Fernando Castillo reaches the motel parking lot after a 30-minute walk from the laundromat. He's headed towards his room on the first floor of the two-story building. His phone is in one hand, a suitcase filled with clean clothes in the other.
Right now I'm coming from church too. I spent 2 hours there in prayer.
He is a man of the evangelical faith, he says. So when he came to the United States to work, it was important for him to find a church.
During the week, I can't make it, but on Sunday, I go to distract myself for a few hours and I run my errands, like washing my clothes at the laundromat because there's no place to wash it here.
Sunday is for church and chores. The rest of the week, he and the others are picking oranges and other crops for Elkhorn Packing, a company that provides labor through H-2A visas to big ag farmers. Castillo says he heard about the program through his job back in Tamaulipas, Mexico. It's a good way to make more money, he says.
Because here the salary is a bit more than over there, and to help the bosses.
The bosses he's referring to? They're his parents. The 29-year-old sends money to them and his siblings.
To buy food, to buy whatever they need in Mexico. Because in that country, the salary is not enough to do certain stuff. And the American money over there gives people better benefits.
He says the company takes precautions to keep the workers safe, like spacing them out on the buses that take them to the fields and emphasizing hand washing and mask wearing. I reached out to Elkhorn Packing several times to find out more about its COVID protocols, but no one returned my calls. Castillo, however, says the company also provides COVID-19 tests every 15 days.
At first, some people did get contaminated, but it's because they weren't being careful. But now it's mellowed down a lot.
Castillo hasn't gotten sick. Juan Alvarez, another worker from Tamaulipas, says he's glad he came to California, and he's not worried about catching COVID here. The threat is everywhere, and at least he's earning money.
Well, here, we make more money. The money from here is worth more than where I'm from.
He's not married, he says, but he does send money to a teenage daughter. As he continues talking, one of the foremen, Fidencio Torres Martinez, walks over. He's also made the 1,000-mile journey from Tamaulipas to provide for his wife and 3 young kids. Elkhorn Packing handles the paperwork for their visas and pays for their housing, he says. But the pandemic has made this trip different from the other 2 times he's done migrant labor.
Before we get on the bus, they tell us to wash our hands, put the hand sanitizer on. When we get off work, it's the same thing.
He says the company has also asked them if they're interested in getting the vaccine.
A lot of people said yes, and a lot of people said no. I said yes because I know it's a protection, and that's good for us and our families.
Families that these workers hope to see safely in a few months. For Castillo, the man who goes to church every Sunday, the thought of seeing his family provides another incentive to protect himself against the virus.
I take care of myself here, and they take care of themselves there, and when I return, everyone is happy, and we can return to normalcy.
The men say they will return to Tamaulipas in 3 months. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Madi Bolaños.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Now that vaccines have become more widely available, it's easy to forget that ICUs are still full of COVID-19 patients fighting for their lives alongside battle-weary nurses who have been deep in the trenches of this pandemic for nearly a year. To learn more about the toll it has taken, physically and mentally, I spoke with four registered nurses who work in ICUs throughout the Central Valley. Ashley Bowers from Community Regional Medical Center in Fresno, Connie Green with Kern Medical in Bakersfield, Bridget Wilson with Kaiser Permanente Fresno, and Lauren Paskin with Mercy Medical Center in Merced, who started the conversation.
COVID has changed everything about my home life, my work life, the way that I interact with my coworkers and my patients. I came into this profession wanting to help people. And the last year has been to a point where I feel almost helpless at times, or I can't communicate with the patients the way that I would like to. It's been a huge challenge, down to wearing layers and layers of PPE and being the family's eyes and ears and hands to hold their loved ones' hands as they pass. It's been very challenging in so many ways.
Bridget, I'm certain you could relate to what Lauren was just saying.
Prior to COVID, you know, we had our patients come to us with illnesses and diseases that we knew how to treat. If you had cancer, we knew how to treat you with chemotherapy and radiation. If you have a stroke, we know how to either remove the clot by giving you some medication or having interventions. During COVID, it's been a huge learning curve for everyone. This is a virus unlike any other. The treatment is aimed at supportive care. When I say supportive care, the nurses are turning patients on their bellies to make sure that they can oxygenate. They're on ventilators to assist in their breathing and oxygenation, medications to help decrease inflammation, and vitamins to just help boost the immune system. We've had a lot of success stories, but we've also had a lot of heart-wrenching losses. And, you know, the medical staff, they currently work 8 to 16, sometimes 20 hours in N95s. And, you know, if anybody's ever worn an N95, they're very difficult to breathe in. And they wear these continuously through their shift, not to mention face shields, gowns, and gloves. All of this has made human interaction and communication very difficult. They work a lot of shifts and double shifts to ensure that they have enough nursing staff in this facility so that they do not have to go out of ratio and they can support the patients and the nursing staff without having to work short. You know, I also have the benefit of not only being a nurse, but also being a manager. And my role has shifted quite differently as well throughout COVID. You know, as a manager, we typically have a bird's eye view of our unit. But during COVID, I've worked alongside the nursing staff, having to call families to arrange for visitation, to come see their loved one prior to intubation, because that may be the last time they're going to see them. Sitting with family members, pointing to them that their loved one is not going to make it, calling coroners and the morgue with all COVID cases, helping to sit with the patients when they're passing away because their families can't be there. I mean, this has been a very, very difficult time for anybody who's in the medical field.
Connie, can you continue this thought and maybe talk a bit about the toll this work has taken on you physically, emotionally?
I definitely agree with what both of the other nurses said before. This is a new realm. I've been in a registered nurse for 16 years, and I've never seen anything like this. I have participated in the H1N1 outbreak, but this was nothing like the H1N1 outbreak. I can tell you that in 16 years, I have seen many, many people pass away. We are a level 2 trauma center here at Kern Medical, and that really is nothing new for me. But this was different. The fact that we weren't able to have family there for them, it really showed us the importance of family and the support that they provided for our patients. The fact that we were the only ones there holding their hands, gowned up, as described earlier by Lauren, in this almost, it made you feel disconnected in some ways as you were doing this month after month after month and watching what's going on in the news through the other areas of the United States. And then as it's hitting California, it's almost like we were anticipating it, but we weren't ready for it. but we were ready for it, but not to the extent we would. So there was always this uncertainty. What I've also seen is the mental aspect it's taken on a lot of the nurses, as well as myself. I have a 15-month-old at home. I remember coming home every time I was up in the ICU working, going, did my N95 protect me today? Did my N95 protect me? Did I take my gowns and gloves off, the proper donning and doffing that we're supposed to do? And that mental aspect, when I come home and literally my kids want to run and hug me and I have to stop them, it's one of the most heartbreaking things I think that I've ever experienced in my career on a mental level. I spoke to one of the nurses in the ICU. Her biggest experience, because I can't make this all about only my opinion, watching a son sob and cry on an iPad as they're saying goodbye to their family before they withdraw care or comfort care is absolutely one of the most horrific things mentally I think we can see, because they can't touch their family. They can't communicate with them if they're on a ventilator. They can't be there and get that closure that usually nurses, especially in ICU, are trained to be, that communicator, that facilitator during that end of life process. And it's definitely taken a toll on all of us mentally. And it's visible. It's visible now. We're exhausted. We don't have time to deal with this. We just keep going. And that's what nurses are. We're one of the most resilient professions in the medical field.
Ashley Bowers, take us into the ICU at Community Regional Medical Center. What is it like there now?
Our numbers have, just even in the last 2 months, they have dropped, but we're still seeing the sickest of the sick patients. Although the numbers are less, the severity of the illness is still taking a lot of people. Just to give you a couple of numbers here, in the beginning of January, we had 417 COVID patients within the community medical centers, all the hospitals, and we had nearly 400 employees out. So in the ICU, we were limited on resources. Typically, we take two patients, and a lot of times we had nurses taking three patients. Our resources were limited. We were running with traveling nurses. Two times the military came in to help us out, which we immensely appreciated. Our COVID ICUs grew from one unit to two units, to a surge unit, to a fourth unit, So it was overwhelming. In the beginning, we didn't know what we were dealing with. No one really knew. Now we have a handle on how to support these severely ill COVID patients, but we're still seeing devastation. We're still seeing multiple lives lost, multiple lives from different families lost. We're watching family members go from one room to another room. In a typical flu season, we would see a lot of deaths, especially at Community Regional. We serve the largest area for the valley from LA to Sacramento. So we always see patients come to us for a higher level of care, and we'd see a lot of death. But with COVID, we're seeing four or five times more death. As a nurse, you feel lonely. You only have the other nurses that can relate, or the other respiratory therapists or ancillary staff, all of our supportive people. But outside of the hospital, no one knows what we're going through, and you can't even begin to describe it. So you feel lonely, you feel sad. You're trying to be with these people that are losing their lives and their battle. They came into the hospital maybe walking and talking, and a couple weeks later, they've been with us, and they're medically sedated, medically paralyzed, on their belly, on a ventilator. And then when the ventilator fails, they're going to ECMO. And their families, sometimes the first time seeing them after dropping them off, talking to them on an iPad, and they're hooked up to multiple machines. The gravity of that is just sobering. We're trying to advocate for a healthier community and a safe community. And because people don't understand the gravity of the pandemic, we almost feel untrusted. People don't trust us because they don't see it through our eyes. And it's really hard to believe some of these stories of saving people and just watching people die, holding their hands on the iPads. I mean, you've heard that over and over again, but my first COVID patient back in April last year, and I've worked with nothing but COVID, was a grandfather, and I held his hand the whole time he passed away. And we had about 15 family members zooming in, and it's heartbreaking. And they can't even see me smile at them because I have layers of PPE on. You try to comfort them, but your comfort doesn't come through the way it needs to be, because you look like a robot almost coming into the room. They can hardly hear you. Patients can hardly hear you. You can't communicate with them. When you need something outside of the room, we learned how to write backwards on windows. We learned how to pantomime because they can't read our mouths if we need something, you know, our coworkers. We learned to communicate in other ways that's not verbal. It's been very challenging in more ways than one. And at 10 years working in the ICU, I think this has been my biggest growing year as an ICU nurse, just because of all of the obstacles that we've had to overcome to take care of one patient over and over again. It's been hard, and it's been emotional, but it's also been rewarding when we see positive outcomes. It's worth it. I love what I do, and I think that it's a calling, and I think that the teamwork on our unit has been remarkable, and I'm proud of my coworkers and nursing as a profession.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with a panel of ICU nurses about their experiences during the pandemic. You've just heard from Ashley Bowers, an ICU RN at Community Regional Medical Center. And I'd like to bring Lauren Paskin back into the conversation. You're an RN in the ICU at Mercy Medical Center in Merced. What do you want the public to know?
You know, someone had mentioned that the community doesn't have trust in us, or it feels that way. Based on what we see people doing outside and, you know, gathering together and not listening. And, you know, COVID is very real. It's still spreading. We have a lot of hope for the future with the vaccine, but we need people to know that we're here doing our best and we're being truthful and honest when we tell you these stories of our struggles and what we see patients go through. And we don't want anybody to go through that. It's devastating to whole families. We will have parents and siblings and children from entire families. One patient in particular, he was extubated, and I said, "You made it." And he said, "What happened to me?" And I said, "You know, you came in and you tested positive for COVID-19 and you were on the ventilator, but, you know, you're doing great." And he said, "I'm sorry, but I don't have COVID." It's devastating to hear that, you know, you've put so much of yourself into someone for so long and they still don't believe you. You were there for them, protecting them when they couldn't take care of themselves, and they still don't trust you. And I would like to see trust in our profession again.
That's such a stunning story. And I'd imagine that many of you have had similar experiences with patients. Is that right?
Yes, this is Ashley. We have had family members after family members tell us, "Oh, we didn't think COVID was real. So we just went about our life, or we got together for Christmas." We saw a lot of multiple family members after Christmas. They're like, "We didn't think it would happen to us." And then here they are, you know, watching their loved one fight for their lives to hold on because of COVID-19. I think most of the time it was eye-opening, but there were still a lot of times when family members or even patients didn't believe that they had it, or they felt that it was a hoax, or family members that were coming in for an end-of-life patient refusing to wear a mask because they didn't believe in COVID-19. But here their father was dying from it. It's sad, and it's
frustrating the way the media and all different avenues have kind of driven a wedge between the general population and healthcare workers, because we're struggling to help save lives and we're fighting an uphill battle because of that lack of trust and lack of belief in a virus that is globally deadly.
Connie Green, you are an ICU RN at Kern Medical. How have you managed your mental health through this phenomenally difficult year?
I would have to say that the support of my coworkers, the support of my husband, who is an EMT, but also a current nursing student. My sister is also an RN for Kaiser here in Bakersfield. You don't know what you're experiencing in the hospital, what we are seeing every day. You can't even begin to describe it to somebody who isn't dealing with it. So you have to depend on that debriefing after a horrible day. Losing 3 patients in one day, losing 5 in one day is not the norm for us. As stated before, it is a calling. We're here to save people. To have this, you know, negative look on nurses now. I remember in the beginning of the pandemic, you would see these reports in the media of nurses wearing scrubs out in grocery stores and people being rude to them, saying, "You're bringing COVID to me," or "You're exposing us to COVID." I just don't think mental health-wise, any of the United States population knows how to deal with what hit us last March. So we are targeting that anger out at people, but I feel like healthcare workers are catching it a lot. I know almost daily, if you are an ICU nurse and you get a phone call from a family member, they're upset if you haven't contacted them for every little thing. They're upset if the doctor said he would call and they're not following up with that. It's the nurses who are the communicators for the most part. I will give credit to the social workers. They are helping with this. The case managers are helping. Everyone is stepping up. But I feel like mentally, there's times I feel like whatever we're doing, it's just not enough. And that's hard. Most nurses are fixers. I'm a fixer. I want to fix you. That's why I'm in this profession. And to have that barricade mentally for me day in, day out is difficult to deal with. And then to go home and have to say, well, I can't discuss what happened in front of my 11 and 9-year-old because it puts fear in them. Therefore, it has to be a conversation at a time when I can have that conversation to help my mental health about what I'm seeing with COVID. I couldn't agree more with people saying this isn't real. No, it's real. It's here. We can't change it. And when people come to the hospital, we're the last line of defense. But really, it starts in the community. And to see that the community actually has made this almost a political thing, too, is extremely sad. And I can't even watch the news half the time anymore because of what I'm seeing. So it's definitely something that's, I think, taking a toll on us. But in a lot of reality, it's going to hit someday. But right now, I can't stop. The nurses on this panel, I guarantee, probably feel the same. They can't stop. This is what we're here to do. So someday we will deal with it. But right now, we're not seeing the decrease that's being told out there. So we have to keep going. And that's where mentally I am. I have to keep going and I'll deal with this later. And it's probably not the healthiest, but I can't not do this because I don't want my family to get sick either. And I can educate them, but it could take one person who teaches their family that this isn't real. And we're in the boat that we're in now.
Bridget Wilson, you're an RN in the critical care unit at Kaiser Permanente Fresno. How is this experience? And I want to be clear, the pandemic is far from over. So I'm not framing it as, you know, in that way, right. But how do you anticipate this experience is going to shape you moving forward?
My fear is that when, you know, it's been a year now for the United States with COVID, and we see on the news most recently nurses committing suicide quite often, which is not normally something that we would hear from nursing professions. This pandemic, I fear, has changed nursing forever. I truly think there's probably going to be a mental health crisis in healthcare over the next few years. nurses are experiencing PTSD from all these experiences with the patients and the families and patients dying alone and not being able to save people and putting their blood, sweat, and tears and trying to, and knowing that you come back the next day and your patient's not there is just, it's heart-wrenching. And it happens multiple times per day. We can't go to our families at the end of the day and explain to them what happened because a lot of our families are not in the medical field. So our only outlet usually is to get in our car at the end of the day and drive ourselves home crying and in tears and trying to put in our happy face when we go inside for our family. We are all faced with looking at our mortality in the face every day when we deal with COVID. I mean, a lot of these patients that we're seeing now that are passing away are between 30 and 50, which most of us as nurses, that's our age group, or it's the age group of our children. And it's really difficult. People have not left their houses for a year. I know nursing and medical staff, we've not gone shopping. We've not had human interaction outside of our family, you know, because we really want to safeguard our families. And we've realized over the last year how important life is and how precious it is. And I think for everybody, we're just trying to spend as much time with our families and not having to take the sadness home to them. So, you know, they carry these burdens daily. We grieve silently for every patient that's lost to COVID. And, you know, it is going to be a mental crisis. We're all experiencing depression. And I don't see this as getting better over time. And what I hear is, yes, our numbers are down. And it's a time for all of us to take a breath and kind of regroup, but the anxiety of maybe having another spike is really huge right now. And, you know, the nursing staff are just overwhelmed with anxiety that we will have to go through this again.
There are no words that I could think of to express the gratitude that I have for everything that you have done and everything that you've sacrificed in order to care for your patients. I've been talking to registered nurses, Ashley Bowers from CRMC, Connie Green from Kern Medical, Lauren Paskin from Mercy Medical Center, and Bridget Wilson from Kaiser Permanente Fresno. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Slowly and steadily, COVID-19 is loosening its grip on the San Joaquin Valley. And every day, thousands more people are being vaccinated against the virus. At the same time, the Tulare County Sheriff's Office is facing ongoing litigation surrounding its response to the pandemic in the county jail. Here to walk us through these developments is FM89 health reporter Carrie Klein with our weekly COVID-19 update. Carrie, welcome back.
Thanks, Kathleen.
So before we talk about the jail, bring us up to speed on what's been happening across the valley this week.
Well, new infections continue to drop. Now, around 500 new cases are reported every day in our 7-county area, and that is about the rate we are seeing in early November. Hospital occupancies continue to steadily drop as well. For instance, our regional ICU capacity right now is at about 18%, but remember that for many weeks in December and January, it was at 0%. On the other hand, we're still not seeing deaths slow down the way that cases have, especially in Kern County. But a spokesperson explained, you know, there just simply have been delays in receiving and processing death certificates. And then our vaccine tally is now up to 500,000 doses administered in our region. As for the state reopening blueprint, still all counties in our area are in purple, except for Mariposa, which is in the red tier. Mariposa, however, is actually looking like it'll progress into the orange tier next week, although all others are still solidly in purple for now.
And it's been another big week of vaccine headlines.
Yeah, it is hard to keep up, actually. I mean, the first is that the U.S. has approved a third vaccine, this one from Johnson & Johnson. And although it is less effective than the others, it is still quite effective. And it's also more shelf stable and only needs one dose. So logistically, it's a really big deal. Another big news item is here in California, lots more people are now eligible. Education and childcare employees, food and ag workers, first responders. It's pretty huge. They should be able to get vaccines anywhere there are supplies. size. Plus, some school districts are working out their own special arrangements. For instance, Fresno Unified is getting vaccine clinics from Valley Children's, and Sierra Pacific Orthopedics will be working with Clovis Unified. Vaccine providers are required to set aside 30% of their vaccines for people in this Tier 1B. Earlier this week, Governor Newsom and the state legislature struck a deal to incentivize elementary schools to open by April 1st. There are lots of details and caveats there, so we will save those for a later COVID update. This has also been the first week that the Valley has gotten its vaccine allocation boost, and you can see that online. Many clinics are now opening up hundreds or even thousands of appointments at a time, so if you're looking for an appointment, check online and check often. And just yesterday, Governor Newsom announced that 40% of all vaccines need to be set aside for disadvantaged communities, although with every change that comes, the details of how exactly that will happen on the local scale will need to be worked out by each county.
Earlier this week, President Biden proclaimed that all American adults would have access to the vaccine by the end of May. Do you sense the same level of optimism here at the local level?
Not exactly, no. In media calls this week, health leaders with Fresno County and with Dignity Health Hospitals in Bakersfield all said that the vaccination rate is certainly going to accelerate with the new vaccine, but that the numbers are in such flux, we just don't know what will happen in the coming months. Also, these leaders are very conscious of vaccine hesitancy out in the community. They're concerned that once the most enthusiastic people have gotten their shots, the rollout could slow down as fewer eligible people actually sign up.
Okay, well, let's turn now to Tulare County. Last week, a team of lawyers, including with the ACLU of Northern California, brought a complaint against the county jail regarding its treatment of inmates during the pandemic. Bring us up to speed on this case.
Right, so this is actually an update to a lawsuit originally filed last summer. That initial complaint alleged that the jail didn't provide masks to inmates for months into the pandemic, despite the fact that Sheriff Mike Boudreaux was promoting masks out in the public. And it also alleged that restrictive visitation policies prevented inmates from meeting with attorneys. It also came out at that point that the sheriff's office didn't have a formal social distancing policy in place. There has been some movement in response to the lawsuit. A federal judge denied a request to immediately remedy some of those allegations, but he did grant a temporary restraining order to get the jail to update its prevention measures. So among other things, the judge required the jail to revise its masking policy, which it did, and to submit a social distancing policy in writing.
And now that policy is one of the subjects of this latest document called a supplemental complaint.
Yeah, that's right. And so this supplemental complaint now alleges that the policy keeps inmates in their cells upwards of 23 hours a day, allowing them only an hour or in many cases a half hour for all of their programming and privileges like showering, phone calls, and exercise. Dylan Werner Christ, a policy investigator with the ACLU of Northern California, said this policy from the sheriff is cruel and unusual, and it violates inmates' rights to due process.
Rather than create a social distancing policy, he just locked everyone down in their cells all the time. What I've told a lot of people, what I've talked about this with, is you can't solve one problem by creating another.
I got to speak with one of the plaintiffs from within the Tulare County Jail. His name is Samuel Camposeco, and he pointed out they have less out-of-cell time than in many prisons.
There's no reason why we have to be on 23-hour lockdown when there's some inmates who are in here for a DUI or misdemeanors or just petty charges.
Why are these inmates allowed so little out-of-cell time?
Well, Werner Christ says it's because the jail allows only two inmates out at a time in each unit, although the sheriff's office has not confirmed this to me. And although it might make sense on one level that just minimizing contact with other people is social distancing, Werner Christ argues it's not the only solution and there are more humane ways of doing it.
With social distancing in the outside world, no one is locking you down and making sure you do it all the time. There's an element of trust. There's an element of, we'll let you, you walk on a path and you keep 6 feet apart from the people you pass. I don't see why people who are incarcerated in the facility can't do the exact same thing.
He also advocates for reducing crowding in the jail by releasing nonviolent and medically vulnerable inmates.
Okay, so out of cell time is one of the targets of the complaint. What are the others?
Well, another is COVID testing. The complaint alleges it's still inadequate at the jail. The sheriff's office does have a policy of testing people who've had known exposure to the virus or who have already tested positive, but there doesn't appear to be any surveillance testing of the general population or of the staff. And the ACLU argues this should be happening, especially since there was a surge in cases in December that infected at least 70% of one of the jail's units. Samuel Camposeco, the plaintiff you heard from earlier, said that although he's been in jail since before the pandemic, he has never been tested for the virus. He even alleges that nurses refused to give him a test, even when he had cold sweats and a fever.
It was crazy. It was mind-blowing that if I wasn't incarcerated, I could walk up to any type of station to get a test for free. But we couldn't do that here, despite having symptoms. I just thought that was a lot of negligence.
The complaint also alleges that these conditions combined are contributing to a mental health crisis among inmates. For example, here's Charles Criswell. He's the lead plaintiff on the case, and he was just recently released from jail.
I had a neighbor, and about every 3 days, he pretty much lost it, banging on the door, pushing the button, and trying to get, you know, a cop to come and talk to him. So I heard him say things like, "Man, can I just let me out of the cell for 5 minutes? I'm having an anxiety attack, a panic attack."
And how has Sheriff Boudreau's office responded to the allegations?
Well, Sheriff's Office spokesperson Ashley Schwarm emailed me a statement calling the allegations false. She said they do have robust plans and procedures in place and that the jail is providing the highest level of care and concern for the people incarcerated there. When I asked about some of the specifics of the plaintiff's claims, the sheriff's office did agree to an interview, but then at the last minute, their attorney called me and said they wouldn't be commenting on ongoing litigation. So there are some specific questions I'm just not going to have answers to for a while.
Well, what about this one? How many people have been infected with COVID at the jail?
Well, even that one, Schwarm would not actually confirm that number with me. There is a state dashboard of California's jails, but it's incomplete and many numbers have been redacted. The New York Times COVID tracker, however, does list the total at 192 cases among both inmates and staff at the jail. And in Schwarm's statement, she did at least tell me that there are zero active infections currently at the jail and that no one who's tested positive has ever needed to be hospitalized.
Carrie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. There are a record number of women in Congress who are also raising children under the age of 18. So many that a Moms in the House caucus was established in 2018. But how are the experiences of these working moms influencing legislative priorities? That question is at the center of research co-authored by Fresno State Associate Professor of Political Science, Lisa Bryant. I spoke with her about the study and its origins.
The brainchild of this was actually, I was in graduate school, and while she's not a member of Congress, Sarah Palin sort of burst onto the national political scene, and there was a lot of coverage about how she had a special needs child at home, and people wondered how she could be governor of Alaska while caring for young children, including one with special needs. So that really got me thinking about women serving in elected office while also raising young children and how it affects sort of their legislative agenda and what they think about. So we looked at the House of Representatives and collected information on all women who had served in the House between 1973 and 2013. So it spans 40 years. And that really actually, at the time this is published, was most of the women who had ever served in Congress, because prior to 1973, there just weren't that many women in Congress. And then, of course, we see a huge increase after 1992. But anyway, we collect all the information about women serving in Congress, what districts they came from, and then we collected information on the children that they have. And so there's a congressional directory that's published every year, and members, usually member staffers, but they answer all of these questions about, you know, where they went to school, were they in sororities or fraternities, do they have children, things like that. So we took a lot of information from the congressional directories about whether or not they had children, but it does not always list the ages of the children. So we would go into newspaper archives and we would look up articles about the members when they were running for office, and often they will mention the ages of children. So we could take the age of the child at the time, we'd find that in the archives, you know, subtract it from the year of the article and deduce what year the children were born. Then what we did, we identified policy that we considered to be family-friendly or family-focused policies. And so this is not necessarily just women's issues, right? This is stuff that's focusing on children. So things like school lunch programs, adoption policies, sex trafficking, domestic violence protections, all sorts of things like that. So bills are coded when they're introduced. And so what we did is we used the categories that the bills were coded under and identified 13 categories that focus specifically on children and families. So we looked at who is introducing this legislation, and we compared women who have young children, women who have no children, and women who are in Congress but have adult children, so children who might already be in college or fully grown. And what we found is that women who have young children are more likely to introduce legislation that is focused on children and families than either women with no children or women with adult children.
To what extent does party affiliation factor into your findings?
That's a great question. So actually, we found no difference based on partisanship. So both Republican moms and Democratic moms are thinking about children and thinking about policies that affect children. And some people have expected, you know, that maybe Democratic women and Republican women might introduce different types of policies. And we do find that there is evidence for that. So for example, Democratic women might have introduced more policies that deal with like childcare subsidies, while Republican women might introduce more policies that focus on adoption, for example. So there is some difference in the substance and the focus of the policy, but in terms of the number of pieces of legislation they're introducing, there are not really partisan differences.
I'm wondering how your findings sit within sort of the broader conversation within the academic community.
What we talk about in our research is that a lot of the focus on female representatives or women representatives was on ambition, right? So there's a lot of ambition literature about why women go into politics. How do they fundraise? Do they fundraise as much as men? The answer is yes. Are they recruited as heavily as men? Things like that. And then a lot of the other stuff about their legislative agenda really focused on what we would call women's issues. And so our research tries to differentiate that children's issues are not necessarily inherently on the minds of all women. So, you know, women's healthcare issues or reproductive rights are not necessarily family and child focused policies. Certainly they are related, but we really try and differentiate that there are some things that are maybe universal to women that all women think about or care about or have policies regarding. But having young children at home, we say that there's almost this recency bias that when you're raising children, you're dealing with doctor's appointments, you're dealing with schools, that you're really thinking about those issues, you know, more intensely than somebody who maybe doesn't have children or whose children are in their 30s, right? Because you're trying to balance all of those things on a day-to-day basis while also working and serving people in Congress. And so that's really sort of where we differentiate from some of the general women's representation literature.
And then you're also looking at men with small children or who are raising children as well, right?
Yes. So we've expanded our research and we actually have a bigger project that we're working on where we are looking at men and women. And so parenthood, transitioning from just looking at motherhood to looking at parenthood. And there is some research that shows that fathers with daughters, that it can shape their legislative agenda. So as men, you know, are raising young women, they become a little bit more liberal in, say, reproductive policy, things like that. And so that having a daughter shapes the agenda of men. But there's nothing really on whether or not men were introducing family policies or if it was primarily women carrying the weight of that. So we've expanded our research and we're looking into that. And we find it's actually very interesting. We do find there's a similar set of differences for men, where men with young children are introducing more policy that's focusing on children and families. But it's interesting because women who have no children, which is our lowest category, is equivalent to men with young children. And so you can really see the sort of stark differences here in how parenthood, the role of parenthood, shapes the agenda of lawmakers when you compare men and women.
That is so fascinating. Now, I know you and your co-author took this research and used it to inform an article that you wrote that was published in the Washington Post. How was that received?
It was very well received. So it was published in the Washington Post. It got picked up by the London School of Economics blog, which we were very happy that it went sort of international. And then we actually got invited to present this research to the Moms in the House Caucus in Washington, D.C. last summer. And so we did get to meet with some of the representatives and present this for the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage. They had an event for that. And so it was very nice to have them reach out to us and hear more about our research. There's also been some, there's an organization that recruits mothers to run for office, and they've reached out to us about our research. So we've gotten very good public response.
Well, Lisa Bryant, Associate Professor of Political Science at Fresno State, thank you so much for sharing a bit of this with us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
And finally, StoryCorps San Joaquin. In today's segment, which is in coordination with the Yonsei Memory Project, daughter Nadine Takeuchi asked her mother, Harumi Sasaki, about her experience as a Japanese-American teenager living through the Hiroshima bombing.
I know that you've told me a lot about when you were a little girl, and I know that you were born in El Centro, California. But you never said what it was like growing up in El Centro with your seven brothers and sisters. What was it like in El Centro when you were a little girl?
Real hot.
Real hot.
Hot. And, uh-huh. And you know, we play outside and no shoes.
No shoes? Mm-hmm. You were pretty poor.
Yes.
Didn't have any money.
Yes, yeah.
So what did your parents do in El Centro?
Strawberry picking.
Oh, they picked strawberries. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What did the kids pick strawberries too?
The older kids was picking, but we were so small yet.
Oh,
so.
You were too young because you were under five when you lived there.
Uh-huh.
So when did you move to Japan? How old were you when you moved to Japan?
Four or five
years old.
Yeah.
You were, as you were growing up, World War II was going on. So the war was going on. Did you hear airplanes flying around on top as you were, when you were little, like the United States or any other country? Were they flying over Japan? And
top of our house.
And
we scared so high and go mountain and what do you call that hole and
like a cave in the mountains. I want to know what the day was like, the day that the United States dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. So that morning, they bombed, I think, at 9 o'clock in the morning.
About 8 something.
So they bombed when people were going to work, so there was a lot of people walking around. But you didn't live in the city.
No, country.
You lived out in the country.
So
what happened right before they dropped the bomb? Do you remember?
Everybody, you know, scared and, you know, hiding. A little later, we can't hear the noise or nothing. And then
you heard a big boom. Did you see it?
Oh, yeah.
What did it look like?
Look like, first, sounds, blam.
Okay.
Blam. And then, big.
Was it like smoke?
Smoke and around smoke.
Like mushroom. Did they call it a mushroom cloud or something?
That's
like
why we call mushroom.
It made you move?
Move.
It threw you?
Throw us.
Off the ground? So then these people are all running into your village, right? Because you lived in like a village kind of thing. And so they just walked or they ran over the mountains?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because
and then crying and then no clothes,
mm-hmm.
and then skins are hanging.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, mm-hmm. real bad. And they take them to the church or uh-huh. big place.
Like schools? Uh-huh. Did they use your school?
Yeah, school.
Mm-hmm. What did they do to help them, though?
Oh, wash for them.
Oh, wash them.
Making a food. And
Did a lot of people die?
Oh, yeah.
In the school?
Everybody
and the
take to a church mm-hmm. or school or a place, big place.
Mm-hmm.
And then everybody dying. Everybody dying.
The city was ruined. How about where you were living? Did you rebuild your house? What happened to your
fixer.
House?
We
you had
have
to fix the house
her.
Again.
And then my next brother is burned here.
Kazumi?
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah.
And then he had a bad sickness.
Well, he had a heart condition, and
yeah.
because of that, I think.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then the war ended
mm-hmm.
Right away, I guess, after that. And then you finished school,
mm-hmm.
and then you got married
mm-hmm.
in Japan
mm-hmm.
to Dad, and mm-hmm. then you came back to the United States. Even though you were a United States citizen, and
mm-hmm.
so was Dad, you had a hard time getting back to California.
Yes.
Why?
They think we do a spy or something like that.
Yeah. And plus, uh-huh. I think, well, part of the reason was because Dad was in the camps here
mm-hmm.
and he answered the questionnaire saying no to the loyalty question. He said no, he would not serve in the Army, and no, he would not be loyal to the United States because he was mad.
Yeah.
Well, it's been good to talk about this.
Yes.
It's good for you to talk about this because mm-hmm. some of it was not good, so it's good to get it out.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thanks for talking about
yeah.
it, because uh-huh. I think people can learn from your experiences.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Madi Bolaños, and Sarith Hawk. Technical support is from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in Californians' decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.